So, I've got heaps of music I want to talk about this week. Heaps of deep.
Well, let's do that. Should we start with your adventures? Do you want to start there or do you want to start with the albums?
Yeah, I would like to start there because I've just been thinking about it a lot, and there's actually sort of a lot more to think about than, you know, for me anyway, than just going and seeing like a band that I really, really like, but, you know, I don't know whether I did. Like, no, they're on my bucket list, right? They're a band I really wanted to see live, partially because I think their style of music and that the way that they treat the live experience from what I'd read was really admirable. But I was a little bit shocked by what happened.
We should probably do a little bit of
background.
We should always pretend that
nobody knows what we're talking
about. Maybe this is the first episode of Tripping Pools, a music podcast. I'm Doc Heath Bezo, that this particular listener has heard. So what did you get up to this last weekend?
So we went and saw Jungle, who we've done
two or three albums of at least.
We've definitely done three. I think I talked about the first album as like when we first started this project, and that was one of the new music artists that
it was an example of like at that stage of our lives we were at that point where you stop listening to new music, and this is like one of the examples of a new act that you discovered during the purpose before the Spotify era, before the podcast era.
As I told the guys on Sunday, like I actually discovered this band because Curtis was starting to dance around a bit, and I'm like, oh, I wonder if I can show him some like cool breakdancing videos, and because they have like these guys are famous for using a dance troupe as their videos for all of their videos. They had this song with a young girl breakdancing. And so we watched the shit out of that single and then, you know, got into the album from there. I've always been like down on the album the first time I listened to it, and then slowly over a time period, like it more and more and more until well after the fact, you know, they always become some of my most listenable music. Like I listen to them quite a bit,
which is odd because it's not like it's difficult to get into it. It's not like it's deep and impenetrable and you have to listen to it multiple times to understand it. It is extremely accessible.
It's a weird phenomenon.
As we said last week, 70s, 80s disco in the form of 90s, you know, big beat dance music with very much that 90s big beat DJ vibe that we just want to get the room pumping. We just want everyone to have a fucking good time.
Hold both of those thoughts. So my first thought is the purest form of music is in a 2,000 to 5,000 seat venue. Mid-sized venues are just fucking so good to watch live music in. Like, if I could only ever see live music in venues that size again, I'd be very happy.
Why 2,000 to 5,000 and not 2,000 to 500?
Oh, yeah, like even small venues, but I just think like a smaller venue's not really practical in terms of getting a band like the Black Keys or Jungle or someone to actually do a 500-seat venue.
What was the capacity of the zoo back in the day?
I think it was 1,500 to 2,000, but I could be wrong about that.
And if I look up zoo capacity on the internet, it'll tell me how many fucking giraffes and lions you can fit in it, so I'm not going to do that. It'll tell me how big the student section at the Highlanders rugby games are, because that's also called the zoo.
Yeah. So I'll sort of set the scene in terms of what my expectations were going in. I expected us to get...
You should also say the venue that you went to.
So it's the Fortitude Music Hall, which is sort of up that the top end of the mall. It's not a new venue, but it was the first time I'd been there.
New to you.
New to me. Like purpose-built sort of live music venue.
Did you work out what it used to be? Because I think we had a bit of discussion about trying to work out what it was.
It's not a space that I've been into like that before. Funnily enough, it was very similar to the Rev in its sort of set out and shape. Like a sort of square main floor with a mezzanine around back.
That sounds like a lot of places. That sounds like the arena. That sounds like the fucking roundhouse at New South Wales Uni.
Yeah, and it's for that size venue, it's a pretty classical good setup, I guess. So I sort of expected heaps of the new album with bits of the other albums sprinkled in. And so they started with a banger and then straight away went to probably the song I liked the least, the Eric the Architect song off the new album. And they also didn't have Eric the Architect there because he's only on one track. So it was, you know, just a video of him rapping along, which means they can't really do much with that song, right? Because it's tied into
They're locked into what he does.
Locked into to the video of what he does. So, but it was cool. It was cool seeing them live. The Busy Earning really sort of had the crowd pumped up. They could, yeah, but it seemed like a pretty straight rendition to me. Yeah. Like the second and third songs were two songs off the new album, pretty straight down the line, how they sounded on the record. With a bit more of a live feel.
Do you kind of park them early in the set because you need a few warm-ups?
When I finish the story, I want to talk to you about like setting up a live set and whether or not they just sort of how they structure it, because
it sounds like I'm having the same thoughts in the same order that you had them when you were experiencing this. So I might just let you cook and then we'll talk about it.
And
after.
And it is very structured because these are the things you learn when you don't go out to see as much live music as you used to. But there's a website now for sets, so people like are logging the songs as they're clocking them as they're going, and then. Like literally after the gig, I could look at the set list of exactly what had just transpired.
You can see analytics of what they most commonly play in what order.
That's right. There is actually analytics. There's like a little pie graph of this. This is how many songs off each album.
I wouldn't want that. I'd want the surprise. But then again, I'm weird. You know, I'm not of this generation. Clearly,
so they are playing exactly the same show for all the Australian shows in these sort of mid-sized venues. And I think there's an actual reason for this. So after the two new tracks, they basically went into, now whether or not they expected this or this is just a happy accident of Australian crowds or what, but they started playing sort of they played two or three, like I think it was five actual sort of the real singles that people would love across all the albums. But now, whether or not this is just because of the smaller size, you're not getting many casual fans in. You had like a real sort of big fan base sort of crowd, but it turned into jungle karaoke for about a third of the set. Like, and I'm not talking just the choruses. The whole crowd was singing all of the songs for about five songs. I was just blown away. I was like, holy shit, I didn't realize there were that many sort of hardcore
rusted on
jungle fans. Yeah, because this is, you know, songs from the first, because what kicked it off was a song off the first album. So this is not a whole bunch of, you know, recent fans that have just glommed on to the latest album. These were people that knew all four albums. And that was just cool. And it really reminded me in terms of vibe of the old Resin Dogs show where it just felt like everyone was there to party. Like that's how it.
What's the age like? What's the demog? Is it people your age? Is it all 20-year-olds? Is it somewhere in between?
No, I would say less 20-year-olds, more sort of 30 up.
Okay.
There was definitely a whole bunch of 20-year-olds there, but they weren't.
But more older, active live music goers.
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah, there was a chunk in their 20s, but I would say definitely 30s and 40s dominated the crowd.
So for a good number of them, they were like you. They'd got an away pass somehow.
Yeah, or you know, I guess there's a whole bunch of people that go and see a lot of like my friends that I was there with, like they go to a lot of shows. Like that's their sort of thing.
Yeah.
So at this stage I'm like, oh, this is gonna be cool, right? If we're all just gonna sing along to some jungle songs and everyone have a great time. But then they deliberately sort of did a change up and they used a song that's quite on the album is quite slow and emotional. But did it like this huge sort of dance floor banger with big drops and really big beats. And like it was like the only way I can describe it was like a DJ just trying to get the the dance floor really happening.
So rather just, than just being trying everything you can to make the boiler room work at like Big Day Out 1999 sort of thing.
Yeah, like really lift the energy. And from there, they went into a song that had very little lyrics in it. So it was almost like they were like, okay, the karaoke portion of the night is over, and now we're going into Fatboy Slim mixing jungle songs. And that big beat dance floor vibe, like they really were playing them much bassier, much faster, and they were almost live. No, they were not almost. They were live mixing one song into the other. So, you know, in the outro, they're blending the next song into it with the music. And then so we had like a solid 40-minute Fatboy Slim does jungle big beat dance party. But it was a real distinct change of vibe from, you know, everyone's having fun in a party to, okay, let's sort of really dance. And then they stopped, and then the last song they played was Keep Moving, which was sort of like, you know, a perfect song for a coda. It's like, hey guys, everyone's had a great time. Here's a banger, but keep moving out the door.
Drive safe.
So it just the set just felt super well thought out and really well constructed the way that they did it. And like we talked about the last album, how we thought that last album lent into that big beat dancey sort of feel a little bit more than some of the earlier stuff.
And I don't know whether I thought that, but I'd defer to your. I mean, I've always thought they were always that was their Venn diagram. If you wanted to mash it up.
Yeah, and they played 21 songs. They played 9 or 10 songs off the new album. But I really didn't, like, I got to the end of it and I was like, oh man, was there any song that they didn't play that I was really hoping to hear? And I think there was only one, and that was Platoon off the first album, which was like a song I like personally, but it wasn't a big
song. It's one of those obscure ones that you'd like. That's the kind of thing that you miss out on when they preset the entire set list when they're on the plane over, that you don't get those funky rarities.
So there's two recordings of this tour, one at Red Rocks and one in somewhere in Europe, in Lisbon, I think, because I was like, oh, I really want to go and see whether that karaoke thing happened, like whether they were trying to make it happen or whether it just happened and it just, you know, once it started, everyone got into it.
Whether they preloaded all the sing-along songs at a particular point of the set.
Yeah, they don't play the set the same way in those other two places. Now, they're much, like, obviously, Red Rocks is much bigger, and the show in Spain was it was more like a river stage sort of size venue than a small size venue.
It wasn't like, you know, Primavera Sound or anything, was it?
It might have been, actually.
Actually, I think Primavera Sound is on this weekend, because I was listening to a MotoGP podcast, and the Barcelona round of the MotoGP is on this weekend, and they were joking about the fact that, you know, they might have to do double duty and go to Primavera Sound, the joke being that they're all far too washed for that. But could it be also a production issue where the songs that have to be played relatively straight because they require a lot more production that needs to be preloaded are moved to the front of the set, and then they can do all the live mixing and live reacting and moving things up and moving things down and playing with, you know, more fucking active DJing later in the set, because those are the songs that work better for that. And that might be why they shuffled the running order.
Yeah, so, like, I've been trawling socials to try and find some footage of the Sydney and Melbourne shows to see whether the karaoke thing happened, like, in all of the small venues, or whether it was just a happy accident that the show we were at. But I think it's in my top 5 live shows ever. Like, it was just so well done. And the other thing
is, your top 5 live shows this year.
That's for sure.
I think you need to remember that. There is a bit of recency bias and quite a bit of nostalgia for what the dude you used to be. Come on. Of course there is. You're like, oh, fuck, this was remember when I used to do this all the time? This was fucking awesome. And then you realize, I can't do this shit anymore. I'm too old. I've got too many other commitments.
Like this week has been, like, the commitments after a very, very small amount of sleep, it just, hit a lot harder than they do in New Year.
You seemed a little bit broken the day after, which was the day of the Mavs OKC Game 6, I think. You did seem like you're not operating at full capacity.
I didn't have much gun. Yeah, I'll give it some time and think about it. But I just, it was better than I expected. I expected a really good show, and I was like, super excited about it, and I have been excited about it for a while, and it sort of over-delivered to what I thought. Like, they really like putting on a good live show. Like, you can just see it in there, in the way that they run around the stage and how much fun that they were having.
Because they get to be rock stars, and when you do yeah. music on the computer, you don't expect to be a rock star.
That's right. I guess, too, like, I had wondered about that, whether we would sort of have a little bit of hiding behind your equipment, Chemical Brothers style. But no, they were fully hamming it up. They obviously, you know, it's like, let's get out of the bedroom and have some fun. Ripping show, absolute ripping show. Would definitely, sign me up for the next time they tour, I think. And just some bands are good live bands, right? You know, there's just bands that you see that they just never seem to disappoint live. Like, Resin Dogs were always like that for me. I just don't think there was too many times I didn't enjoy them live. Yeah, good times. Going out, well worth it.
Live music, other things that are fucking hard to do when you're in your mid-40s.
Sure, and like that was like a lot of pre-organisation.
Yes.
You know, just, you know, buying tickets that far out, booking it into the calendar, booking, you know, people to look after three children and get them to school because it was on a Sunday night, not a Saturday night. A whole heap of organisation, but like, if it had sucked, it just would have really would have hurt with that much organisation.
But I don't think it could have sucked unless they'd forgotten to plug their shit in, because you'd put so much effort into it, you were going to have a good time no matter what.
Yeah, and Ace had, like, Ace had seen them last tour, I think, and when I was, like, when the tour got announced but the tickets hadn't been released, he was like, you have to go and see that. Yeah. You'll love this show.
This is friend of the show, Ace McWicked from Drive Thru Pod.
Yeah, and I had a bit of a chat to him about it afterwards, and he's like, yeah, your experience sounded like my experience last tour. So I just appreciate a band that, like you said, they're two guys behind a computer. They don't have to put the amount of effort in to present you with a live experience that is that big and that powerful, but they obviously put a bit of thought in.
Yeah, but the best acts in that genre do.
Yeah.
And they clearly get as much out of it as the audience does. Because if you've got an audience who are singing along to the silly songs that you've wrote on your fucking computer.
Yeah. Oh, it'd be so much fun.
Yeah.
I was like, I don't know. As a performer, because that was the other thing, like, watching those bigger shows where you weren't get, like, the crowd was obviously into it, but it was just the nature of the beast, I guess. If you've got 10,000 people instead of
1,000,
a couple of thousand, yeah.
Depersonalized.
Yeah, well, it's just like, oh, I liked Back on 54, you know, it's a pretty cool song, I'll buy a ticket and go to the show, whereas this seemed like a whole bunch of people that was really across the material.
I think you've penalized them 20.
Yeah.
I think it's 74, isn't it?
There's one song that's got 54 on the title and one that's got 74 on the title. Yeah. I always get them mixed up.
20 more. They're just trying to outdo Spinal Tap.
All right. So that was live music. Shall we talk new music?
We sure. Why don't we start with someone else who seems to have a particular love for a certain kind of 90s dance music? Your friend Nia Archives.
So this is sort of my second surprise of the week, which was, like, now I'm so conditioned by so many poor choices,
yeah,
that I expect every dance act to be auto-tuned rubbish.
Yeah, I mean, she's not a dance act. What she is, I mean, and I should point out that last week we sort of said, oh, you know, she normally works with the same producer that worked with Sims on Sims's last EP that we didn't like, so this is probably, you know, whatever. She's not working with that guy. She's working with a different guy, but it doesn't really seem to matter who she works with, because this is her sound, and her sound is a bit like as though Nia had just finished this pretty reflective R&B-influenced indie pop album, and, you know, she wasn't that happy with the mix, so she gave it to a mate who knew a bit of Pro Tools and said, can you just clean up the mix a bit? But the problem is that her friend happened to be, like, the biggest fucking 90s house music head and just stuck breakbeats on everything. And then if there was a gap between the breakbeats, he put more breakbeats and just couldn't fucking stop himself. Except that person is also Nia, because she just loves sticking breakbeats in fucking everything. I went back and looked at my notes from when we'd done her EP, which was actually just last year. Sunrise, Bang Your Head Against the Wall, which is no longer on Spotify, which is interesting. And that was with the last producer. But that was all breakbeats and more breakbeats and just more incredibly 90s breakbeats. And the line I actually had there was, this is the most interesting album of the week. Unfortunately, it's only an EP, so it's not going to make album of the year, but this is like a super upbeat Faithless. What are we doing here?
I was like, Lily Allen did a Breakbeats album, which is a little bit unfair to her. She's got a
That's criminal.
A slightly different voice. But, man, I enjoyed the shit out of this. It was like, those beats are just going to keep on coming, and more and more and more of them.
Once you get over the oddness of it, and I do wonder what kind of album it would be without it. When you first hear it, it's a bit like, remember that Andy Cooper album, which was a collaboration with the soul singer that he works with. And it was like her soul music, and then he would burst in with, I'm here, Andy Cooper, out of here to see. And he's sort of Kool-Aid man his way through the wall and just burst in and do these fucking white man raps. And it was like, this doesn't really work. But given that every song has the breakbeats on it, that you quickly become accustomed to, this is just her vibe.
Yeah, this is just her thing.
She just really likes stuff sounding like jungle. Not the jungle that you went to see, but the fucking genre from like 1992. Jungle.
Yes, there were so many amens in this, you could have gone to church.
Yes. Good line. Were you working on that?
Well, but I was just like, oh, because the first one I was like, oh, there's the, because I'm always pointing out to Vanessa, the arm in break, right? I'm like, oh, here's the arm in break in this song. Here's the arm in break
in this song. That's nice, dear.
But normally it's like, you know, one little bit. This is just like the whole thing.
This was like a Southern Baptist church. There's so many fucking amens.
That's right. But the funny thing was, you know, it's big because both the other albums are very consistent in their style all the way through too. But out of the three, this was the one that I didn't get tired of quickly. And it was the one where at the start where I'm like, well, this is going to get old really quick. But whatever it was, the mix of her voice and those breaks actually became more compelling as it went along. Like it was a bit jarring for the first song, and I just liked it more and more the more I heard it. Yeah, I rated this album. It was cool.
Yeah.
Where should we go next?
Well, we should maybe go to the other dance-influenced album, which was the Zootons' comeback album, first album in 16 years. Nile Rodgers on the fucking boards. And I think my expectations for this were a bit higher than what they delivered. This kind of, I was looking for a bit more oomph. This is kind of a bit down in oomph. It does feel a bit too old. I mean, it's fine. There's decent ideas and the production is solid, but it's generally a bit too safe. And a bit too adult, contemporary, kind of easy listening, smooth FM vibes. It's kind of, it didn't really have a huge amount of energy.
My notes, right down to his vocal tone, was this was the most 70s album I've ever heard in my life. Even his voice sounds like it's straight out of the 70s. I can't explain it. It's got a timbre to it.
Yeah, or a production choice.
Yeah, maybe.
That was informed by, you know, the people they got on there. But it made me want to go back and listen to Reef's last album, because that's, you know, if you're an old soul kind of throwback act, which is, you know, what the Zootons are and what, you know, they're riffing off old soul and R&B tropes. And Reef were maybe a bit more rock than that, but that had energy coming out of its asshole. That had real vibrancy and real fucking oomph. And the album just kind of felt like it was at about, you know, 70% throttle the whole time. And
do you reckon it had like a bit of hippy dippiness to it, like a bit of Age of the Aquarius? Like,
I didn't think it was interesting enough to do that. You know, it just seemed very, very conventional.
Every time I thought they were going to try and do something interesting, they'd waffle into something.
But they chose not to.
Much less interesting.
Every choice they made was to walk away from something that was interesting, which I thought was disappointing. Because, you know, Nile Rodgers has helmed some of the best fucking disco, funk, soul stuff of the late 70s and early 80s, and he's probably got tired as well, I guess. It just felt old. I think we should say that, you know, out of the two new albums, I mean, I didn't feel either album hit it out of the park, but yours definitely had more to it. So you get the Joker for next week.
I really like that Near Archives album. I quite like that.
Yeah, I thought, as I say, it's not my space, but I thought it had a lot more to it than this. This didn't really, you know, it quickly got an assessment of what it was about, whereas I think the Neo Archives album still has the capacity to kind of surprise and delight.
All right, tell me about Slash.
Slash's album is a good album, but it's difficult to get a fresh take on songs that everybody has done, and there are so many versions that every possible way of doing these songs has been done, so it's almost like they couldn't go for the obvious way or the best way to do this stuff. There's better versions of all these songs somewhere on Wax, you know. Oh Well, which is the old Fleetwood Mac song before, when Fleetwood Mac were a blues band before Stevie Nicks and Hair and, you know, Rumours and all that shit came along. Jimmy Page and the Black Crowes did a fantastic version of Oh Well on their live album. Killing Floor was done by Hendrix. Hoochie Coochie Man, everyone's had a crack at. Born Under a Bad Sign, Cream in Eric Clapton's pre-racist era was tremendous. That doesn't make it a bad album. It just means that they're operating with a slight disadvantage because you can't just do the good song the way that everybody knows it.
It's their line.
Yeah, you got to pick a different way. And one thing I noticed about this is a little bit like Slash's first solo album from about 2010, where he had a whole lot of different guest vocalists. Like he had Ozzy Osbourne and Lemmy and the dude from The Cult. And then he would do the song in the style that they knew, if you know what I mean. Like the Ozzy song could have been in like an Ozzy Osbourne single track. The Lemmy song could have been a Motorhead song. There was a Andrew Stockdale song, which could have been a Wolfmother song, you know. And with this, he's made the song with Chris Stapleton into a much more of a country steel guitar twang kind of thing. I don't think it doesn't make them bad, but it makes them maybe not the best version of them. But they're extremely well played, and it's probably my favourite album of the week. But it's got an unfair advantage because it's based on a whole lot of songs that I already like. So, you know, and you'd think with a title straight out of like a 70s Italian nunsploitation tits and horror film, you'd think he would have taken a few more adventurous swings. But it is very safe.
Yeah.
And I think that's kind of a bit, it makes it much more like the Zootons album than it is like anything else.
Yeah, my sort of attitude by the end of it was like, why? If you're going to do it, like,
take a few swings?
Yeah, to do something rather than just sort of basically recreate it. An album version or another version of the song.
Yeah, and in a lot of cases, quite cabaret. I mean, the Demi Lovato things, like 8 minutes of Papa Was a Rolling Stone, done exactly like fucking Tina Turner would have done it. It's like, well, we've already heard that. Like Tina Turner would have done it, except about 30% worse because it was Demi Lovato.
Like you're one of the most amazing guitarists ever, like, maybe freestyle a little bit. I don't know.
Yeah, it didn't really feel Slash forward, did it? Like, it could have just been, particularly like the first track, which was The Pusher with Chris Robinson on it. It didn't really feel like, I mean, Slash was incidental. It was like he was guesting on someone else's stuff.
Well, it almost felt like a really, really good high school band.
Yeah.
You know, doing excellent covers.
Excellent, clean covers. Because they were
exactly as they were done.
Even the version of Killing Floor was so clean. I mean, I think of fucking Hendrix or Muddy Waters or John Lee Hooker or even like Led Zeppelin ripped off Killing Floor at least twice with songs, and theirs was much more, even with a three piece, was much more ragged assed and you know, I mean, Led Zeppelin were the band that heavy metal, the term, was invented for. You know, it felt like heavy metal was falling from the sky was the gig review, because it was loud and obnoxious and raucous and you know, by comparison to the music of today, obviously it's a lot more polished. But yeah, I just felt like it was a little bit too clean. It was a little bit too variety show, Royal Command performance. What I thought was interesting, though, that he's so dedicated to the bit that he's a guitar hero and, you know, he lives with his Gibson SG in his hand, that his music publisher is literally Gibson Brands Incorporated. His guitar sponsor is his music publisher.
His publisher.
This entire album was done as a promotion for the Gibson Les Paul. I think that's absolutely Les Pauling.
He's like the guitar version of a mountain bike rider, you know, like doing everything for the sponsor.
Yeah, it's basically, this is like Red Bull TV, but in music form.
Music. All right. Well, I have the Joker, so I'm going to go duo week, and I'm going to go with something, an older band and a new band. So for the older band, I'm going to go a band called Arab Strap. And
are they older? I didn't think they were that old.
Well, it's their eighth album.
Yeah, but that could have been done in 15 seconds.
That's
are they named after a Belle and Sebastian song by any chance?
Could be. Great album title, though. I'm totally fine with it. Don't give a fuck anymore.
You left out the emojis.
Oh, is there emojis in it as well, is there? That's not on Metacritic.
Totally fine with it. Thumbs up. Don't give a fuck anymore. Thumbs up.
All right. Even better.
Yes. I don't think they were named after the song The Boy with the Arab Strap, because they were named
before it.
Well, their first album was 96, and that song from Bill and Sebastian came out in 98. I just think it happens to be a slightly
coincidental,
racist-seeming title.
All right, what have you got that is new this week?
Oh, I thought you were going to tell me what your duo was.
Oh, okay, man. So they're one duo. They're a Scottish duo, and then
I thought the album was a duo of albums. I didn't realise you were talking about.
No, no. I'm going. Oh, well, it is. It's a duo of duos. So the other duo is a British punk duo called Big Special, and their album is called Post Industrial Hometown Blues.
Yes, I have heard a bit of their stuff. It is a bit shouty, but we'll find out whether that's inescapable issue or not by the end of their probably not very long album.
Mm-hmm.
What else do you know about Big Special while I pad for time?
I don't know where these guys...
B-I-G-S-P-H-E-L.
They came up. They're on my long list. They're on my long list for my jokers, which probably means I've heard a song and gone, that's not good enough for me to like, but it's good enough to listen to and have a crack at.
Maybe Doc will like this shit.
Yeah,
yes.
Right.
All their titles are in caps, and one of their songs is called I Mock Joggers. Another of their songs is called Shithouse. So that sounds like
right down your alley.
I don't think they are, because as I said, I listened to them as a potential listen, and I thought, no, I'm not going to pick that. So looks like I'm being led back by the nose.
I could have picked Lenny Kravitz, so.
Hey, you're giving away my fucking joker. I saw that they got 69 on Metacritic, which is nice. And it's impressive that it's that high, I suppose. I'm going to go middle of the road US stuff, I think. I'm going to go for Cage the Elephant. Their first album in a couple of years is out. I think they're a reliable good time. I don't think they're going to, you know, burn down any walls, but they have a new album out. It's called Neon Pill. I think they were more adventurous in their younger ages, the younger days, but we'll see how this turns out.
Did you want to talk about the Apple 100 albums thing?
Is there a way of talking about it without sounding like a bunch of fucking get off my lawn cloud shouters?
Well,
because what's to say is that it seems extremely dominated by people who listen to the opinions of American music critics who are in their early 40s. Like, the only people I've ever heard say that the Miseducation of Lauryn Hill is any good are Black American music critics or Black American culture people. And I'm not sure that they believe that's true. But I also don't believe it's true that that's the best album in the history of recorded music.
No. And there was a lot of Jay-Z and Eminem and 50 Cent and...
I mean, but there was also the usual boomer bait shit.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
Abbey Road was 3, wasn't it? This is the thing. I mean, you can go through and critique it. The thing is that the selections were made up by Apple Music staff plus Pharrell and a bunch of other fucking artists, like Charlie XCX, people you don't fucking actually want to listen to. So Lauryn Hill was first, Thriller was second. I mean, Thriller's not as good as Off the Wall, but anyway, Abbey Road, Purple Rain, Frank Ocean, Blonde, Songs in the Key of Life, Good Kid, Mad City by Kendrick, Amy Winehouse, Back to Black, Nevermind, and Lemonade is your top 10. And then you've got Rumours, OK Computer, Jay-Z, The Blueprint, Bob Dylan, Highway 61 Revisited, Adele 21, Joni Mitchell, Blue, Marvin Gaye, What's Going On, 1989, Taylor's version, not the real one. The Chronic, Pet Sounds, and then Revolver. So that's the first Beatles double up. In terms of albums I would actually want to listen to, okay, I could do maybe one out of the top 20.
I still like OK Computer.
No, it's not my favourite at all. Maybe three out of the top 30. Back in Black's in the top 100. There we are. I'm happy enough.
I guess what I took out of it is that there's this nostalgia, right, for music being a collective experience. And I actually
think... Well, this is actually a much more intelligent point than anything I was going to make. Go on, keep going.
Well, I actually think, like, this is a very small pond and music is actually this massive fucking ocean.
Frank Ocean.
With lots of really equally as good albums as, like, the Beatles weren't the Beatles because they were the best music going around. They were the Beatles because they were the best marketed music going around, and they were popular.
Well, like, yes and no. I think they were the best band of their era, but they just happened to be in the era where the biggest population spike went through when there was a monoculture.
Yeah.
Like, if there was a monoculture now and we had the literal baby boom going through right now, then fucking, you know, Taylor Swift would be would be the biggest and greatest. And for a large group of, you know, 15 to 45-year-old women, she is.
Yeah, and I think if you think, like Lemonade's not even close to Beyoncé's best album.
But she beat up Jay-Z's car in it, so that's important. And Fleetwood Mac's got that album where they're all mean to each other because they're all breaking up, notwithstanding the fact that they were much better when they were, well, it was Peter Green's blues band.
These are albums that have cultural wide, like, they have significance within the stuff that surrounds the music, you know, so that, that they made an impact.
These are actually like more cultural albums than they are anything else. I mean, Rolling Hills album wouldn't be here if it wasn't for the fact that she never did anything subsequently. And it was this kind of bizarre, staggering piss wreck that it constantly embarrasses itself since.
You know, we talk about narrative for the MVP. Well, these are narrative musical things. They're not, and I actually think it's really, you know, so it was pointed out to me that, like, how much I have derided Californication over the years about being a crap album. And I think I've listened to enough music now where it's like,
not in the list.
I don't really hold that opinion.
I just checked.
No, I don't really hold that opinion anymore. It's just like they made a decision to go a different way with their music, and that's their decision, and it's fine. I don't have to think about it being bad because I've got so many other albums that are bad I can think about. Like, there's literally so many.
It was a personal disappointment. It's a bit like a friendship that's broken up or something. You know, you're like, it's God, I wish that person hadn't turned into a bell end and you'd sort of had to get them out of your life. They made some bad decisions and they got into crypto or went down a fucking conspiracy theory rabbit hole or, you know, started voting liberal. You know, whatever it is. You just say, well, I'm irritated because I had to break up with the experience that I had with the Red Hot Chili Peppers, and they are not the band that they used to be.
And at that stage too, there was only X amount of bands that I actually liked. You know, so a new album from one of those bands was like
it really was being like being let down by your friends.
Yeah, it was a massive deal. Where it's now, it's like, well, that's another week gone. On to the next week. Like, it is a bit blasé, and it's a side effect of doing music the way that we do. But doing music the way that we do has made me realize that there's just actually a lot of really good music out there. There's a lot of average music and a lot of bad music as well. But like, I just don't have the headspace to be
upset about it.
Super upset about a bad album from a band that I used to like. I really still like the Chili Peppers that I like.
I don't. But I think I'm kind of past it, to be honest.
Yeah, well, and there's a lot.
It feels like something that you have to go through in your life. And they were kind of the prototype jam band, I suppose. People who really got into it then got into fucking Fish and Dave Matthews.
Yeah.
I would like this list better if it wasn't numbered. I'd feel more comfortable with it because I think the rating of it, saying that Appetite for the Destruction is 52nd and Back in Black is 90, therefore, you know,
it's 40.
That's not 41. Correct. That is not the right order. But if you just say they're all in the top 100 albums, okay, I can accept that. Paul's Boutique is the best Beastie Boys album. That's an interesting call. I don't mind that. I think that's probably more because it's certainly not the most popular, but it's probably the most significant. But having Paul's Boutique behind a Drake album seems fucking preposterous. But again, take the numbers out, then it becomes much more realistic.
Like every now and again, I go back and read that exercise that you and I did when we were doing the written version of this podcast.
Yeah.
Of
course, I don't stand by any of that.
Yeah, like I look at that and go, what the fuck were you thinking? Like, would half of those albums even make my top 100 anymore?
Oh, Back in Black would still be my number one just because I'm loyal. I'm a good person.
Yes. Yeah, it's... I don't know. It's so. I just think it's a. There's a mob that does the 100 greatest movies every decade or something, and you know they use there's a similar sort of methodology. You know, critics and artists and stuff like that. And I just think that film is such a smaller pool to wade in that it's in some ways just easier to get your head around. But
well, it's also fewer of them can be made and get. You know, it's much harder to get movies out to the market.
That's right.
Well, until Netflix came along. Compared to with music, you can just put it on a streaming service and there's a lot more of them about. It's interesting with the number of albums per decade. There's sort of a big kind of spike in the 70s through the 90s and then another spike in the 2010s. which probably illustrates the fact that if it wasn't for the young people they brought in there, it would have been the usual kind of boomer-dominated chart that these things always turn out to be, because people just pencil in the Beatles and the Stones and Stevie Wonder and fucking whoever else, because that's who – they've been around long enough that their music has imposed itself on everybody. Yeah, I don't have a – the point of these lists is to have people talking about the Apple Music service.
Sure.
And I don't use the Apple Music service, so therefore I win.
And I just, like, lists are fun. Like, even they're fun to put together. Like, I almost want to go, I wonder what my top 100 albums would be, you know?
We did that. And, like, I do. We literally did that.
But I reckon if I did it now, I would, 2 weeks later, I go, well, that was a bit fucking, you forgot this? What about this? Yeah. Like, how could you have that this high? And,
anyway. I don't believe in ranking them anyway. I mean, ranking it is actually the toughest part of our album of the year thing, because usually you end up, later that year, you end up going, why did I have that fourth? That should have been second. You know, I think we should just celebrate things that are good. Unless they're The Miseducation of Lauryn Hill, which is just, baffles me, and that feels like it was put there in order to get people to talk about their list. Because if they had Thriller or Abbey Road or Purple Rain as the number one, nobody would have fucking said a word about it. They would have said, oh, whatever. Gen X takes over again. But it's actually probably late boomers.
At least it wasn't an Eminem album at number one.
There's one in here.
There is one. Well, there's like
Marshall Mathers LP's in there.
Get Rich or Die Trying's in there, and it's like,
okay, I prefer that to the Marshall Mathers LP. Well, this is directly behind fucking Norman fucking Rockwell fucking. So, and there's a Bad Buddy album in here as well. So basically, they're just trying to not offend all of the people, all of the different genres that listen to their service. This is
all the time.
This is not anything other than a way of promoting their service to their users.
And I did try Apple Music for a while, and I felt like I was philosophically against their curation. Their curation felt very like it was being curated by someone who worked for Oz Stereo.
it felt like the hidden hand of a record company executive was somewhere in there.
Yeah,
well,
that's right.
That's exactly what I feel when I look at this list, and it feels like something from 1995. This idea that let's keep trying to maintain the hegemony of, or the hegemony, depending on how you pronounce it, of big labels and big acts. This list is fucking irrelevant.
Yep. Well, that's where I thought we'd end up anyway.
Yep.
All right, Doc. Live music is good. Yep. I'm going to do it again.
Apple Music is average. We're not going to do that again. Yeah. Everyone's album lists suck except for ours. And even then, I don't think we agree with each other.
That's true.
And if you can't be with the music you love, love the music you're with. Or worse to that effect.
Thanks, Doc. Thanks for indulging me about the live stuff.
Well, I'm living vicariously through you because I can't or won't go to live music anymore. So that's fine with me.
And I'll talk to you next week.
We will catch you next week.
See ya. So my list of artists I would like to see live.
As a sync from the ones you'd like to see dead.
Like Kid Rock. who are potentially going to tour, right? You know, like not ones that are, so obviously, you know, the Bobby Lees in a space like that would be awesome, but I just don't think that's ever gonna happen.
They'll be much more likely in like the Waterloo or somewhere sort of scabbier, I would imagine.
Well, but haven't they just given up on touring? Like, isn't that?
I don't know what they're up to recently, because a while ago they said, "Oh fuck, we can't afford to do this." And then I think a lot of their fans started. There was a big surge in Bandcamp and merch and stuff. So I don't know.
I don't know whether I would like to see Bob Dylan live. Michael Kiwakama.
I don't know what kind of show that. So the problem with two pieces is you're never really quite sure what kind of show they're going to give you.
I would have liked to have gone and seen Chasing Status. That would have been fun, I think.
Yeah, you haven't mentioned that before.
Yeah, and then, I don't know. I
see myself, like, seeing the Ghost of Freddy Caesar tour, like seeing Troy Kingy when he did the Ghost of Freddy Caesar, but this, he's got so much variability. I don't know whether...
I heard his latest thing. You're not going to... Can you guess the genre of where Troy Kingy's next thing is going to be? Because he's still doing his 10 in 10. He's about halfway through now, I suppose. Can you guess the genre he's going to try next?
Has he done, like, straight R&B?
I mean, he's done soul, essentially.
Yeah, it's close. Taylor Swift-style pop?
No.
I don't know what it was.
No. No.
Thrash metal?
Closer.
Oh.
It's almost like fucking... It's almost like new metal of the early 2000s. Not quite as shouty and screaming, but because he doesn't do that sort of stuff. But I thought, this feels like a Queens of the Stone Age knockoff.
Wow. Okay. Okay. That would be interesting.
He just likes fucking with shit.
Yeah. Fucking nice to be that talented.